pouring concrete is hard work. It's sort of like that. A solid base must be prepared before anything else is done. Then when the concrete is poured, it must be shaped before it sets, because once it sets, change is impossible, or it's possible only by removing what has already been laid down. If it's done correctly, a well-poured footing will last far beyond its original owner's lifetime, and if done incorrectly, the evidence will appear soon enough in the form of a crumbling surface, structural cracks, a shift in walls and floors. Raising children is like pouring concrete. Before a baby arrives, a couple should prepare a solid base in their marriage, and they should share a readiness for parenting. After the child arrives, the first few years can be compared to the time before the concrete sets. The child is malleable, pliable, able to be shaped and molded. It was either St. Francis Xavier or Aristotle who said, "Give me a child until he is seven, and I will show you the man." The early years of a child's life are crucial in forming what the child will be for the rest of his or her life. The concrete illustration points to the fact that it is not likely that any mortal will have more influence on the spiritual welfare of children than the parent. Statements like, "As goes the family, so goes the nation, and the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world," recognize the critical role parents have in molding and shaping the character of their children. Someone once asked, "When was the best time to begin preparing a child to serve the Lord?" The answer given was, "With the grandparents." Now, why would anybody give an answer like that? In the first place, it's not practical. You can't change the past. And if your parents and your grandparents were both messes in terms of morals and decency, or if they were messes in regard to healthy relationships, if they were basically dysfunctional, nothing can be done at this point to change all that, so why bring it up? Because it underscores the necessity of beginning to prepare as soon as possible, and it introduces a point that I believe is critical in addressing a key principle in parenting, a principle that I believe is crucial, yet so often ignored. We are the products of our parents, and our parents are the products of their parents. And all the behaviors that are so deeply ingrained in us have their inception back there and even further back than that. This idea can be found in a principle stated a few times in the Old Testament. It is first found in the Decalogue, that is the Ten Commandments back in the Old Testament, then stated three more times in the books of the law. I'll be reading from the second record of it, which is found in Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. The text tells us that the Lord spoke to Moses and said, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. If the grandfather is an alcoholic and abuses his wife and children, this greatly increases the likelihood that his children are going to have similar difficulties in life and in any relationship, including the relationships with their children. Then those children will either repeat those behaviors, or in trying to be the opposite of what their father was, They'll typically overcorrect and go to an extreme in a different direction, but they will still most likely be dysfunctional in their relationships and dysfunctional in raising their own children. This is not to say that we can justify ourselves for any and all conduct by pointing the finger of blame to our ancestors. Ezekiel chapter 18 makes that clear when it says, "The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. The righteousness of the righteous will be credited to them, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them." So we can't cast all our blame on our predecessors. But if there were strong dysfunctional behaviors in your parents, in all probability there were strong dysfunctional behaviors in their parents, and there will be naturally strong dysfunctional thinking and behaviors in you, and they will continue to be passed on unless you identify them, unless you are honest about them, and unless you intentionally make serious efforts to correct them. This really shouldn't be offensive. And quite frankly, this should be nothing new, should not be news to anybody. Sayings such as, "like father, like son," and "the apple doesn't fall far from the tree," these are sayings, these are axioms, because they are so true, so obvious. They've stood the test of time, having been witnessed by countless people throughout the ages. But before we get into more discussion about what all of that means, let's take a moment to consider some thoughts on how one should begin preparing for a baby. If you were to ask people how they should prepare for parenting, many would likely start thinking of getting a baby crib, clothes, mobiles, infant toys, a good supply of diapers, blankets. They would be thinking about fixing up the room, a baby shower, things like that. And there's nothing wrong with those things. Nothing in and of themselves wrong with that. Others might think of reading books on parenting, buying baby books, maybe reading books on developmental psychology. They may read things like the different views that developmental psychologists have regarding how children become adults. For example, is there a predictable pattern children follow regarding thought and language and social development? Do children go through gradual changes, or are the changes abrupt? On this topic, they'll read the different views that are held by leading psychologists, such as the continuity view says that change is gradual, that some children become skillful in thinking, more skillful in thinking, talking, or acting much the same way as they get taller. Then they'll read about the discontinuity view, which sees development as more abrupt. Now, then that information may be interesting to some people. It may even be fascinating to a handful. But I'll suggest to you that learning such information means nothing in terms of how your children will turn out socially, morally, and spiritually. And as nice as it may be to have all those things mentioned earlier, none of them are necessary to raise a godly child. I want to suggest to you that the best thing you can do to prepare for the baby is to become your best self. And by that I mean to become the most stable and faithful Christian that you can be. As Christians, when we consider our roles as parents, we immediately think of statements like, "train up a child in the way he should go," and "fathers, bring up your children in the training and admonition of the Lord." And those teachings are true, and they're good, and they're right. God wants parents to bring up their children in the training and admonition of the Lord, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Parents certainly have obligations to them that go far beyond providing food, clothing, and shelter. And leaving the Lord out of child rearing is to sin against God and against the child. But I fear we become too focused on teaching and training our children, too focused on instructing them, sometimes to the complete neglect of what I believe is supremely more important, that which I believe is perhaps the most critical element in parenting or in any other relationship for that matter. I become convinced through the decades that parenting should be more focused on what the parent is and on what the parent should be rather than on what the parent should do, per se. To underscore this point, consider the Pharisee and the tax collector in Luke chapter 18. Verses 10 through 14 says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Then Jesus says, I tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. Was Jesus more concerned about what these men did, or was he more concerned about what these men were? Jesus never taught here or anywhere else that what we do does not matter. But he did teach that the primary thing is what we are. Changing our heart is the key to changing our behavior and the key to changing our lives. And so we ask, which comes first, the do or the be? For example, how can you be the best employee that you can be? Notice how Paul addressed this in Colossians 3, 22 through 24. He said, slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you and to curry their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Paul instructs these Christian slaves to be obedient to their masters, but notice where Paul places his emphasis. He said, obey with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. He didn't just say obey through gritted teeth. He said, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Paul is saying you are a Christian first. He's saying if you get yourself right, then what you do will be right. Concern yourself with what you are, and what you do will take care of itself. Now you're still going to need to be taught things, but if you get all the techniques right, yet you're not focusing on what you should be, all the good and right things you do are going to be meaningless anyway as far as concerns eternity. Do we sometimes lose sight of that? But it's easier and less demanding to focus on what you should do rather than focusing on what you are. And a lot of literature seems to encourage that. Who wants to try to fix themselves when they can wade through a sea of techniques in search of the answer on how to fix their child? And if the child does not turn out right, then we can blame the things we learned, or we can blame the things we didn't learn, or we can blame the things we did or the things we didn't do. And of course, we can always blame the child, the wretched little incorrigible child, but by all means, let's not blame ourselves for what we were and what we are. And I'm sorry if that sounds too cynical, but the matter of the fact is, with few exceptions, what the parents are is precisely what has shaped and molded the child to be what that child is. And rather than be offended by this, This information should actually be liberating. Why should it be liberating? Because if the problem is me, I can do something about that. It's no longer having an issue of having a child that I can't fix. If I am the problem, I can fix that. And bless that handful of souls who have the humility, the honesty, and the courage to say, yes, I realize that the problem might be me. You know, when someone ends a relationship and they say, it's not you, it's me. Well, Grumpy Cat has a different approach to that. Grumpy Cat says, it's not me, it's you. You're the problem. Well, as Christians in all situations and relationships, we need to have the honesty and humility to say, maybe it is me. Maybe I'm at fault here. And we need to have that same attitude regarding problems with our children. That's the difference between the thousands on Pentecost who owned up to their guilt by asking, what shall we do? And those who gnashed their teeth at Stephen and stoned him to death when they were confronted with the fact that they were the problem. Just as there's no hope for the addict until he or she admits they are an addict, neither is there hope for the frustrated parent who's ready to pull their hair out until at least they acknowledge the possibility that they may be a big part of the problem. Techniques alone are insufficient when you're dealing with human relationships. There must be changes of attitude, changes of heart. For example, does it matter why you do things? Is it okay to do all the right things for the wrong reasons? Would that satisfy you in a relationship? And would you like that kind of obedience from your children? Is God satisfied with that kind of relationship with his people? I call our attention to Malachi's day, the people in that day, Malachi 1, verses 6 through 8. The text says, a son honors his father and a slave his master. If I am a father, where is the honor due me? If I am a master, where is the respect due me, says the Lord Almighty? It is you priests who show contempt for my name, but you ask, how have we shown contempt for your name? By offering defiled food on my altar. But you ask, how have we defiled you? By saying the Lord's table is contemptible. When you offer blind animals for sacrifice, is that not wrong? When you sacrifice lame or diseased animals, is that not wrong? God had become so tired of it all. He told them to just go ahead and close up the temple. Why wait? Just get on with it. He said in verse 10, who is there among you who would shut the doors so that you would not kindle fire on my altar in vain? It matters why we do things. In Luke chapter 15, the prodigal's elder brother stated emphatically that he had always done the right things. To his father, he said, look, these many years I have served you and I have never disobeyed your command. Now, whether that was true or not, that's the view that he held, and he was placing his argument on that. Then he proceeded to grumble. He proceeded to complain and badmouth first his brother, then his father. He had done all the right things, but it didn't do him any good. He wasn't better for it. But my point goes deeper than that. If someone says through gritted teeth, I love you, does that matter to you? How they said it? They said the right words, but what impact did that have on you? It impacts you just the opposite of what the words actually meant. But they said the right words, doesn't that count for something? Well, actually, no. The words said, I love you, but the message said, I can't stand you. Fact is, you would most likely prefer they had said nothing at all. Consider the impact that Judas Iscariot's kiss had on Christ. It was a kiss. Isn't that a nice thing? If a parent says the right words or uses the right technique in training or correcting a child, but they express those words or carry out that technique with an attitude of spite, malice, bitterness, or anger, how effective will that technique or those words be? They will often, I should leave out often, they will have the opposite impact of what was intended. But too often the parent washes their hands and says, I've tried it all, nothing works, this child is unfixable, irreparable, they are incorrigible. And so if there's one key to being a good parent, I believe it is this: fix yourself first. This is not just a lesson about parenting, I might add. If I'm to be the husband I should be, I must fix myself first. If I'm to be the best employee I should be, I must fix myself first. If I'm to be the best parent I should be, I must fix myself first. You can try to teach your kids, train your kids, fill their heads with all kinds of knowledge, but if you are a mess, if you've got tons of baggage, and if you're not trying to fix your own mess, that will come through in everything you say. It will come across in your attitude. It will come across in how you treat your children. This is a hard thing to hear. It's a difficult thing to consider. It's a troubling proposition to face. Because if that's the case, then the question becomes whether my children will continue to suffer because I am unwilling to change. In Genesis 4, when Cain found out that his sacrifice did not please God, he was upset. God told him, sin lies at your door and its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. God said, you, Cain, you are the problem. You need to examine yourself. And you need to straighten yourself out. But what did Cain do? He refused to consider that he was the problem. And he directed his malice toward his brother Abel, and he killed him. Cain killed Abel because Cain wasn't willing to look at himself. This is a common theme in the Bible. In Genesis 3, God confronted Adam about his sin in the garden. Adam's immediate response was to point the finger at Eve. Don't talk about me, talk about her. In 1 Samuel, King Saul chased David all around the southern part of Judah, thinking that if he killed David, that would solve his own problems. But Saul's problem was himself. Saul had turned away from the Lord. In 1 Kings 18, after a 3-year drought, when Ahab met Elijah, Ahab's first words to him were, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" And Elijah's response was spot on. He said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals." Ahab's trouble was of his own making. His wickedness, his idolatry, his sin. What's going on inside of us, what we are dealing with internally, our unmet needs, our skeletons, our baggage, all of these things impact our relationship with others. These things affect every relationship we have. They affect how we view others, what we expect from others, how we interpret the comments and actions of others, and so much more. On our recent trip to California, Debbie and I had a layover in the Phoenix airport. I went to the Wendy's in the airport to get something, and as I walked up to the cash register, another guy was approaching the cash register from the wrong side of the line. You know how you got those barriers there that indicate, and he was coming up from the wrong side. And so I simply got out of the proper side of the line and walked around behind him to let him go first. As he finished his order, began to step over to where you pick up the food, another lady and her mother and a young child came walking up to the cash register from the correct side, which now I was on the wrong side. She made a rude remark about me trying to get in line from the wrong side. Even though she'd seen me standing there as she was walking up, I simply said, "You go ahead, please." Then I stepped back and I walked around the bar and got on the right side again. When this lady was ordering from the cashier, she made some unkind remark about some cups that were sitting back at the wall. I'm not going to get into what it was about. It doesn't matter. And with great reserve, the cashier kindly explained that the lady was incorrect. Well, the lady said a few more unkind things before she was finished. This poor lady must have left there feeling pretty low. It seems everybody she encountered had a bad attitude. You get the point. I'm sure we've all come across people like this. We've seen people take things in ways that we knew the other person did not mean at all. This is what happens when you're not willing to consider that you may be part of the problem. In Matthew 7, verses 3 through 5, Jesus said, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own eye?" Then notice verse 5. Jesus said, "You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." Jesus tells them that they will have the ability to try to correct others only when they have cleaned up their own life. New Testament scholar Leon Morris once said, "It's a curious feature of the human race that a profound ignorance of oneself is often combined with an arrogant presumption of knowledge about others, especially about their faults. I have to straighten myself up before I even have the ability to properly assess flaws in the lives of others." And that principle applies to every relationship we have. All these principles apply to every relationship we have, but they also apply to relationships we have with our children. Having a log in my eye makes me unqualified to see accurately, period. As parents, we need to be willing to consider what we are doing, what our attitude is, how we react, what tone we are setting, all of which may be contributing to the child's attitude and behavior, all of which may be exacerbating the behavior, or that may even be the root cause of the child's attitude and behaviors. Being open to the possibility that we may be a big part of the problem is the first step, often, in the right direction. It will help us to immediately begin to be more open to looking at the problems we're encountering in the light of what we may be contributing to those problems. And I've had to face this message in my own life at times. It's not an easy thing to face. I just happened to be flipping through a book on parenting this past week. It's a book by Dr. Kevin Lehman. Internet says he's an internationally renowned psychologist, New York Times best-selling author of more than 30 books. I say all that to acknowledge this man's particular knowledge and expertise in this area. So anyway, I was flipping through this book, and I literally stumbled up on this on page 231. I included it because it's so pertinent to the point that I'm making. In the question and answer portion of the book, someone's question began like this. They said, "Our son is 3.5, and we want to know how to handle his anger, particularly the anger he shows when he's disciplined." Part of the response was this. He said, "The first thing I would check is how I am disciplining my son. His anger indicates that you may be coming on too strong." He said, "The saying goes, If you have a powerful, angry child, the chances are you have a powerful and probably angry parent. If I don't fix myself first, getting rid of my own metaphorical demons, my own skeletons, my own baggage, I will pass those things, those attitudes, those behaviors, those characteristics onto my children. The fact is, what we do, what we say, our attitudes, our disposition, our demeanor, the tone of our voice, our facial expressions, all speak volumes to our children as they watch and observe us day after day. In what became a huge hit in 1983, the Police sang, "Every move you make, every breath you take, I'll be watching you." There's never an adult who does not remember the example of his or her parents. There's never an adult who was not significantly affected by that example. Albert Schweitzer said, "Example is not the main thing influencing others. It is the only thing. All the teaching, all the training, all the lecturing, all the imparting of knowledge will do little good if the parent is not exhibiting the fruits of the Spirit in their life." In Galatians 5, 22 and 23, Paul tells us that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. As young Johnny reached for the phone on Saturday evening, his dad said, "If it's that guy from the office, tell him I'm not home." That evening, the family went out for dinner. Before leaving the restaurant, Johnny's mother looked at the check and mentioned that the waitress had undercharged them. Johnny's father mumbled, "That's their tough luck." On the way home, they joked about that box that Dad had bought for the dashboard of the car. He called it the Fuzz Buster. And he bragged that it had already paid for itself when considering the speeding tickets he might otherwise have gotten. Later that evening, as Johnny finished his Bible class lesson for church the next morning, he thought of what a good Saturday it had been. Much better than last weekend when his father had grounded him for cheating on his math test. Nothing worries a parent more than that uneasy feeling that children, their children, are relying more on their parents' example than on their advice. That the child's behavior is a reenactment in their own lives of the temperament, the attitudes, the behaviors that they are seeing in their parents, rather than following what they are being taught. Our children follow in our footsteps. They are replicating, they are duplicating the love and the peace, or the anger and violence, or the apathy and indifference that they are witnessing in the lives of mom and dad. You can't give your children what you yourself do not have. But more than that, we bring our own problems to our children. Abraham Lincoln said there's just one way to bring up a child in the way he should go, and that is to travel that way yourself. I'm confident that everybody here loves their children. But because you love them does not mean you'll never get frustrated at them. It does not mean that you will not sometimes be ready to pull your hair out or theirs. I'm not suggesting that children cannot test every ounce of patience and long-suffering that you have. They can. And when you start having difficulties with your children, all of your flaws and all of your inadequacies will be magnified tenfold. All your fears, your anger, your bitterness, your anxiety will come pouring out on those children. And you don't want that. This congregation has been richly blessed with little ones, and I plan to do some lessons on this topic in the upcoming weeks. And I hope I can say something that's beneficial for someone. There are lots of things I wish people had said to me as a younger parent. As a parent, if I had a dollar for every error in judgment, for every foolish mistake I made, for everything I said and did that was a bad influence on my children, I would have a lot more money than I have now. And if you think that doesn't bother me, you don't know me well at all. And so I don't mean to be standing up here acting like I know all the answers. I don't. And I don't mean to be standing up here acting like I was the perfect parent to my children. I was not. And I need to say that this is not an easy topic to preach on, because I recognize the possibility of offending someone, and that's the last thing I want to do. My desire is to help. It would have been a lot easier for me to have not preached this at all. I didn't have to. Or to have just done a typical parenting lesson on bringing up the child in the training and admonition of the Lord. Again, I know everyone here loves their children. You love your children. And you don't want to do things that impact them negatively. You want what is best for them. You want what is good for them. You want them to do right. You want them to grow. You want them to thrive socially, morally, but especially spiritually. And it is to that end that I offer this lesson and others I will present in the upcoming weeks.